From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, working with one of the most despised groups of people in America, we'll talk with attorney Brian Stevenson. He represents death row inmates in Alabama. He began working with them when he realized they had no one to represent them in court. Now he heads an organization that recruits attorneys to take on death row prisoners. Also, we meet actor Miguel Ferrer, best known for his role as Albert, the caustic FBI pathologist on Twin Peaks. Now he stars in David Lynch's new sitcom, On the Air. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Home Fires, a new NBC show from the creators of St. Elsewhere. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Reports from the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia say that heavy fighting is continuing in several regions. The reports also say that the Serbian bombardment has eased slightly. More from Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Sarajevo residents said the city was rocked during the day by a number of powerful explosions. The Serbian militias in the hills overlooking the city maintain their systematic artillery and mortar bombardment. Bosnian health authorities said three people had been killed and 15 wounded, considerably less than the average death toll in recent days. Heavy fighting was reported in northern and central Bosnia as Serbian forces maintained their efforts to punch a road corridor to Serbia. Clashes were also continuing in neighboring Croatia, with Serbian artillery attacking the Adriatic ports of Dubrovnik and Šibenik and Croatian forces shelling Knin and Trebinje. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The president of Yugoslavia attempted to rally Serbs today in defiance of growing world condemnation of Serbian aggression in Bosnia. Dobrika Kosic is a Serbian author who was elected last month to serve as president of what remains of Yugoslavia, a two-republic federation composed of Serbia and Montenegro. Kosic is a friend and advisor of Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and is thought to be the source of the policy that all Serbs should live in an extended republic. One day after Israel's national election, opposition Labor Party leader Yitzhak Rabin has begun talking about what kind of changes he'd like to make. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Speaking at a news conference in Tel Aviv, Labor Party leader Yitzhak Rabin said he had not yet begun negotiations to put together a coalition, but he said he would like a wider coalition than with just the left-wing Meretz bloc. Rabin also said he would like to give the Palestinians autonomy or self-rule within 9 months, and he proposed frequent negotiations to achieve this. Rabin also said he would sharply curtail Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, although he said he did not want a Palestinian state in these areas. As for the Golan Heights, Rabin assured the 12,000 Jewish settlers there that Israel would never withdraw. Jewish settlers in the occupied territories are nervous that Rabin's election could lead to an eventual Israeli pullout, a move they say they will fight. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A Coast Guard cutter returned 83 Haitians to Port-au-Prince today, the last of more than 27,000 refugees who were intercepted at sea and denied asylum in the United States. U.S. officials said that the tent city at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba is being dismantled. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 3,290.7. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of about 194 million shares. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court ruled today that federally required health warnings on cigarette packs don't shield tobacco companies from personal injury lawsuits under state laws. The court said that cigarette companies can still be sued in state courts for allegedly misrepresenting the dangers of smoking. The ruling came in a New Jersey case filed by the family of Rose Cipollone, who died of lung cancer at the age of 58 after 42 years of smoking. The justices voted 7-2 to allow the family to sue the cigarette companies on grounds of concealing smoking dangers. A strike against one railroad has set off a chain reaction that shut down most of the nation's railroad system today. The White House has asked Congress to pass emergency legislation that would end the strike. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The shutdown began shortly after midnight when the Machinists Union went on strike against one railroad, CSX. But by dawn, virtually all of the nation's 40 largest freight railroads had stopped running. Amtrak, the nation's passenger line, also canceled its service, except along the Washington-Boston corridor. The railroads claim that they were forced to shut down since they rely on CSX track, but the unions say that the shutdown was a tactic designed to pressure Congress into ending the strike by imposing a contract that favors management. Today, Transportation Secretary Andrew Card urged Congress to take swift action. About one-third of the nation's intercity freight is shipped by the railroads, and economists say that a prolonged strike could endanger the nation's fragile economic recovery. In Washington, I'm Eric Weiner.
An independent U.S. Trade Commission ruled today that the big three American automakers are not hurt by Japanese auto companies' practice of selling minivans at artificially low prices in the U.S. market. The practice is known as dumping, but the International Trade Commission said it's not causing financial harm to the U.S. automakers. An industry spokesman said the decision is a loss for thousands of American auto workers. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The pace of executions in America has been mounting ever since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. The Supreme Court has made it more difficult for death row prisoners to appeal their cases. We're only halfway through 1992, and there have already been more executions this year than in all of 1991. This makes the work of my guest very difficult and unpopular. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer who represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. He's the founding director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. Stevenson says he realizes that most Americans support the death penalty, but even they should be concerned about the racial bias with which it is administered. Stevenson grew up in rural Delaware and graduated from Harvard Law School. He told me how he was first exposed to death row.
It was almost 10 years ago when I went to Atlanta, Georgia, to work with a group called the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. As a law student, I took a course at Harvard Law School in race and poverty litigation, and one of the requirements of the course was that you go to an organization doing public interest litigation. I went to Atlanta and spent a month there, and it was really a very engaging, very overwhelming experience for me because I met death row prisoners, and I encountered the reality of death penalty litigation in this country, and I was very, very affected by it. I think what was most challenging to me was that there were all these people, many of whom reminded me of the folks I grew up with, who were on death row, unable to get adequate legal representation. And it became very clear to me that these folks had very, very severe problems, obviously awaiting execution, that were almost entirely dependent on, and they were entirely dependent on lawyers to solve those problems, and they weren't getting the help they needed.
Why weren't they getting the help they needed?
Well, there is no right to counsel for anyone once they've been convicted and sentenced to death and their case has been appealed to the state appellate court. There is no longer a right to counsel, so that we now have close to 2,600 people on death row in this country, all of whom will have no right to legal assistance once their case has been reviewed by one appellate court. So that if their case is to be challenged in federal courts or in subsequent appeals, they must rely on lawyers to volunteer their services to provide them with the representation that they need.
So here you were, it was your first time on death row, you saw these problems, but what made you think this was your work?
Well, my image of what a lawyer is was really framed as a kid growing up in southern Delaware. I grew up in a rural community. And I never really met any lawyers as a young kid. I never really met any lawyers until I got to law school. So I didn't really have a sense of who they were and what they were, but I did have an image that really was shaped by the civil rights movement. I knew that it was lawyers who came into southern Delaware and made Brown versus Board of Education applicable to the public school system in my community. I knew that it took lawyers to open up the public schools for little black kids like me. And I also had some appreciation that but for the work of lawyers to challenge society, to do things that society didn't want to do, to represent people who didn't have the means or resources to obtain representation, I wouldn't have had an opportunity to graduate from high school and go on to law school because Brown was just that critical to my development. So that idea that a lawyer was someone who really sort of stood with people who needed legal representation, the person who could make a difference for disadvantaged people, people with very, very unpopular problems, was really what framed my understanding of who a lawyer is and what motivated me to go to law school.
You know, I bet a lot of people, though, think or say to you that, you know, as an African-American lawyer, you'd be doing a better service to the African-American community trying to work with people who you were convinced were innocent, or maybe trying to prosecute drug dealers who were terrorizing neighborhoods, as opposed to working with people on death row whose cases, A, might be hopeless, and B, you might be representing people who are guilty anyway.
Well, I think, you know, it has always been true that because there are so few African-American lawyers in this society generally, and the problems in the African-American community are so diverse and so complex, there's always an argument that your time could be better spent serving some other part of the community or dealing with some other problem. But I think there is something quite important about standing with the people who need legal assistance the most. And there's certainly no question that in this society, people who have been accused of very serious crimes, very horrible crimes, and the people who have been convicted and sentenced to death are the people who are perhaps the most despised, the most rejected, the most hated in our society. And I think that anyone, African-American or other, that chooses to stand with these people and say, no, even these folks are entitled to legal representation, even these people are entitled to equal justice and fair representation and fair review of their cases. By doing that, I think that we create some hope and opportunity for other folks who are also in need and are also not getting the assistance that they so desperately deserve.
How do you decide whose case to take on?
Well, it's not that difficult for us. We represent or are involved in providing assistance to everyone on death row in Alabama. We try to recruit lawyers for the folks on death row that we can, and anyone who we can't recruit a lawyer for, we step in and provide representation. So basically, if we can't find another lawyer, a firm, or someone to provide pro bono assistance, then we end up taking the case.
Now, what are you usually trying to do, prove a prisoner's innocence or just trying to prevent their execution?
Well, I think what we end up doing in death penalty litigation in this era is just trying to get them a fair trial. I mean, most of the cases that we work on are cases where the evidence of unfairness is quite overwhelming. That is, many of these people do not get adequate legal representation at the trial level. They may have been represented by lawyers who did not meet with them before the trial, who did not do any investigation into the mitigating factors that are important for a jury's decision as to whether they live or die. They may not have evaluated the state's evidence or investigated the case very adequately. Then there are other issues. Racial bias and racial discrimination is a very prominent feature of the way in which the death penalty works in this country, and challenging that is an important part of the kind of representation that we provide. A lot of people on death row have mental health issues, mental health problems, and explaining what those problems are and getting courts to deal honestly with what it means to be mentally retarded or mentally ill in the course of one of these crimes or one of these cases is another part of what we might try to do. But all in all, yes, we're trying to establish that the person was not properly convicted of the crime, and in some cases where the evidence of guilt is overwhelming, you may be just talking about whether the person is properly subject to the death penalty.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson. He's the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. This is a group that represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. When you're working with prisoners on death row, do you always find things in the prisoners who ask you to represent them? Do you always find things to like or to respect about them? Or are there times when you're working with someone who you really think is just, you know, a horrible and frightening, terribly dangerous person?
You know, I think when we say we're going to execute someone, what we're really saying is that this person's life has no purpose, this person's life has no value, this person is beyond redemption. And in my experience in working with death row prisoners, I've just never encountered that person. Every client I've ever had has convinced me or shown me enough humanity that I think his life is worth sparing, that his life still has some value, his life still has some purpose. No question, he's got to be punished if he's guilty of a crime that tragically ended another person's life. But no, I've never had any difficulty finding something human, something redeeming, something purposeful in the lives of my clients. And, you know, I think the notion of who is the death row prisoner is one that's not clearly understood. I think we have images of Charles Manson and, you know, Hollywood versions of the mastermind criminal who kills and kills like, you know, you and I eat potato chips or something, as the typical death row prisoner. And in fact, that's not who is ending up on death row in this country because of the problems with racial bias, because of the problems with adequate legal representation. Many of the people who end up on death row are people that you and most of your listeners know. They're on the streets, they're young kids, they're folks who are struggling and get into a difficult situation and tragically commit a crime that results in death. But they're not so different from the people I grew up with. They're not so different from a lot of people in this society who are struggling and struggling to try to kind of stay on this side of the fence. And I never have any difficulties in dealing with my clients and seeing some purpose in their lives, some meaning and something useful about keeping them alive.
Do you see part of your role as a lawyer representing prisoners on death row as providing comfort in the hours before execution if they are facing imminent execution?
Well, I think, I do think it's important for, I believe in the human, you know, I guess if I believe that there's something redemptive or something purposeful in their lives, I need to show that, and I want them to understand that I believe it. I think too many people end up on death row because they feel like nobody cares about them, that the system, it doesn't make a difference whether they tell the truth about what happened, it doesn't make a difference if they try to explain, it doesn't make a difference if they try to show the jury that they really do still have something to offer. And it's important for me that my clients understand that that's not an issue as far as I'm concerned, that I do want to see them live. And I think, you know, if society's going to execute these people in our name, that is, in the name of the people of the state of Alabama, or the people of Pennsylvania or whatever, everybody has an equal investment in that. But yes, it is important. And it's sometimes difficult. There's no question that when I was in law school and I was growing up, I'm not sure anything prepared me for some of the difficult moments that I've had in providing representation to people on death row. Certainly going down and spending the last 15 minutes with someone before he's executed, before a guard comes up and says, you know, you got to leave now so we can shave his body to put him in the electric chair, or dealing with all of the issues that come around those experiences it's certainly difficult, and I'm not sure anything formally prepares you for that, but I think it's important that you be prepared to be a witness to everyone's humanity, which is what I see myself as trying to be.
What have you found you were capable of saying to someone who is facing death in 15 minutes that wouldn't be of a kind of easy, comforting cliche? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting. I think most death row prisoners are in such desperate need of, committed and capable legal representation that you end up not saying much at all. I mean, your clients end up doing most of the talking to you. I think because they're grateful that someone had the courage or had was willing to stand with them when it seems like everyone else is standing against them. And most of my clients are just very appreciative of any legal representation that they can get, and like to use that time trying to express that more so than you're trying to prepare them for something.
Mm-hmm. Do you sit in on the execution?
I have not in the cases that I've been involved in that have resulted in executions, but that just depends on the case, the client, and the circumstances.
Why have you so far decided not to?
It was not something that either client deemed necessary or important or wanted me to do, so I didn't.
So you've had, what, two clients then who
we
have
got
actually gotten executed?
We got involved in two cases very late in the stage. One we got involved 2 weeks before a scheduled execution, and one we got involved in the case about a month before a scheduled execution. In both of those cases, we were unable to get a stay of execution, and those clients were executed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson, the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center, a group which represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian Stevenson. We're talking about his work representing prisoners on Alabama's death row. Can you give us an example of something specific that made you feel really discouraged?
Mm-hmm. You know, there have been some very difficult moments in the last 8 years when I've been representing death row prisoners. But I really think when I think about the most difficult moment, it was actually when I was reading a decision from the United States Supreme Court back in 1987. In 1987, the Supreme Court held in a case called McCluskey versus Kemp that even though he had presented statistical evidence that you're 11 times more likely to get the death penalty in the state of Georgia if the victim is white than if the victim is black, that you're 22 times more likely to get the death penalty if the defendant is black and the victim is white, that he was not entitled to relief under a claim that racial bias had undermined or contributed to the death sentence in his particular case. And the court said two things in that decision which were very, very discouraging to me. I mean, the first thing the court said was, well, if we start dealing with racial bias and sentencing in the death penalty context, it's just a matter of time before lawyers come back and start complaining about racial bias and sentencing in burglary offenses or drug offenses or property offenses and other crimes. It's what Justice Brennan termed this fear of too much justice, which led the court away from responding to the evidence presented by McCluskey. The second thing the court said was even more discouraging. The court said that certain disparities based on race, in effect, a certain amount of racial discrimination in the criminal justice system is inevitable. And that was the word used by Justice Powell writing for the majority. And I thought about that in the context of my own life. I mean, in 1954, the Supreme Court could have said that racially segregated school systems are inevitable. White parents don't want their kids going to school with black kids. We've got economic and other barriers to getting equal opportunities for black kids to get a high school degree. And it's just an inevitable feature of this society. But the court didn't say that. They said it was unconstitutional, and its unconstitutionality made it not inevitable. The court didn't say it in the criminal justice system, again, because I think we have this view that when we're talking about people who have been accused of criminal conduct, it's okay to discriminate. It's okay to tolerate gross evidence of racial bias. That was the most discouraging thing for me because it really sort of accepted this idea that we can allow racial bias, we can concede defeat to racial discrimination, racial injustice in the society if we're just talking about the right kind of people, if we're just talking about people unpopular enough that nobody will get mad when we do it. And I think more than dealing with some, difficult executions and seeing some really serious problems go uncorrected, that decision was very, very, very discouraging because it really does symbolize, and here's this court with equal justice under the law and scrawled on its building, in effect, conceding defeat to a very, very disturbing reality that surrounds this criminal justice system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson. We're talking about his work representing prisoners on Alabama's death row. Could you physically describe for us what death row is like in the prisons of Alabama?
Well, it varies. There are three prisons in my state that have folks under sentence of death. We have five women under a death sentence, and they're kept at the women's prison. Most death row prisoners in this country are kept in pretty much total seclusion. Many of them spend 23 hours a day in their cells. They're let out for less than an hour each day for a shower or for some walk around the yard or recreation. There are many times when you don't even get that 1 hour out. So it's a pretty isolated, pretty bleak existence. They're not allowed to integrate with other prisoners so that, unlike perhaps other prisoners in society that have an opportunity to kind of get to know other folks in the prison or meet people who kind of come from their part of the state or part of the community or whatever, death row prisoners are kind of isolated from most of those contacts.
When you're meeting with a death row prisoner who isn't exposed to other people because they're not let out of the cell and they're in solitary confinement, if they've been there a long time, is it hard for them in a way to hold a conversation with you because they're just not used to it?
No, I think the more difficult thing for them is that there's so much that they want to talk about. There's so many needs that they want to address. There's so many problems that they need to confront that there just doesn't seem to be enough time to do it all in one attorney visit. And you have to understand that many of the folks on death row don't get visits from anyone but their attorneys, and some of them don't even get regular visits from them. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I first did this work was meeting someone on death row who told me, when I went down to see him, that I was the first person that that came to visit him in over 3 years. And obviously, when you haven't had a chance to talk to anybody, in person for that amount of time, You know, there's a lot of stuff that comes out that you want to talk about, and it's kind of hard to do it all at one time.
Have you had to learn how to say no because of the demands on your time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think anybody who gets involved in the criminal justice system learns that you know, if you're prepared to really make a difference, if you're prepared to make a commitment and really sort of stand with people, the demands are going to be overwhelming. You'll get that very quickly because it's just so many needs. So yes, you absolutely have to learn to say no. And it's a difficult thing when you see people who have very, very serious problems who need legal assistance but cannot get it. And, you know, knowing that you could provide it if there was just enough time in the day is difficult. But in fairness to your other clients, you just have to.
So what do you say? In fairness to my other clients, I have to say no?
Sure. I mean, I think about it. You know, we've got lots of kids, who have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. I mean, some of these cases are very, very sad to me because, you know, we've got 14-year-olds who are indicted for capital murder in the state of Alabama. What they then decide to do after they've been indicted for capital murder is to plead guilty to the capital crime and accept a sentence of life imprisonment without parole, just so they can avoid the death penalty. And many of these kids are in my view, not legally responsible for the crime. You know, they were, you know, outside in the car while somebody else went in a store and killed someone and whatnot. And you could I have a lot of problems, or you could have a lot of problems with whether it's appropriate that they get that kind of sentence at the age of 14 for that kind of behavior, particularly when some of them have no prior criminal record, et cetera. But because we sort of work just in the death penalty area, it makes it very difficult to, you know, take the time away and say, well, I'll step in and try to provide you representation. And that's very difficult because you see that problem and you know that it's an unjust situation.
You've seen a range of people in solitary on death row facing death. What's the range of effects you've seen it have on personality?
Well, I think, you know, for many people, it's very demoralizing, and you know, it becomes difficult for them to just sort of hang in there. I mean, the suicide rate among death row prisoners is very, very, very high. For other people, and I think this is sad and sort of ironic, for the first time, they have an opportunity to kind of really sort of think about what they're doing in ways where they're not being distracted by just a devastating drug addiction or by, you know, the burdens and the responsibilities of trying to survive on the streets. And some of those people experience growth, if you can imagine. But I think for everyone, it's very, very, very difficult just to kind of know that at any point you're going to be hauled out of your cell and strapped in an electric chair and kind of burned to death. I mean, I think that reality makes it emotionally difficult for anyone under sentence of death. But, you know, that's something that you just have to deal with. I mean, when someone commits a terrible crime, they're going to be punished, and that punishment is going to include, obviously, some discomfort, some difficulty. And I don't think that's illegitimate. I think that's reasonable, and I think that's responsible. The question is, what kind of punishment? And obviously, that's where we spend most of our time addressing our concerns.
Brian Stevenson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Stevenson is the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. This is a group that represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Miguel Ferrer had a small part in the TV series Twin Peaks, but he made a big impression. He was Albert, the FBI pathologist who breezed into town with a superior attitude and a deadpan expression. Ferrer was also an evil executive in the film RoboCop. Now he's the hot-headed network executive in David Lynch's new farce, On the Air. Coming up, we meet actor Miguel Ferrer. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Home Fires, the new show from the creators of St. Elsewhere. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. By a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld its 30-year-long ban on officially sponsored worship in public schools by banning prayers at graduation ceremonies led by a member of the clergy. Since 1962, the High Court has banned organized prayer sessions in public schools. And the High Court has made it easier for people to sue tobacco companies on claims that they deceive the public about the dangers of smoking. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Today's decision was a victory for the family of Rose Cipollone, a New Jersey woman who'd been smoking for 42 years when she died of lung cancer in 1984. Before she died, she sued several tobacco companies under New Jersey law, claiming they'd lied about the health risks of smoking. The tobacco industry argued that because they put warning labels on their products, as required by a law that Congress passed in 1965, they could not be sued under New Jersey law because federal law takes precedence over state laws. But the Supreme Court disagreed by a majority of 7-2. Justice John Paul Stevens, writing for the majority, said the company's duty not to deceive is not preempted by federal law. After today's decision, both sides predicted it would open the doors for a new wave of lawsuits against the tobacco industry. This is Dan Charles in Washington.
Likely independent presidential candidate Ross Perot has strongly denied reports that he has investigated his own employees, his children, and President Bush. Laura Canoy reports.
Perot repeatedly blasted what he called the Republican dirty tricks crowd for digging up rumors about him and feeding them to the media. The Texas billionaire charged all the stories are coming out now because the GOP expects Perot will announce on his birthday at the end of this week.
Day after day after day, they're swarming all over the country looking for anything. Their people are digging and searching, digging and searching, digging and searching, the whole opposition research group.
Perot said the only time he's investigated anyone was when he suspected several employees were stealing from his company. The rest of the allegations about probes of Perot's children, President Bush, and Bush's family, Perot called Mickey Mouse. Earlier in the day, Perot's Maryland supporters presented him with 150,000 signatures, almost 100,000 more than he needs to get on the Maryland ballot. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy reporting.
NASA officials say that bad weather could delay launch of the space shuttle Columbia tomorrow. Liftoff is now set for shortly after noon, after last-minute problems were corrected. But weather forecasters also expect stormy weather near the Kennedy Space Center. A spokesman says there's a 60% chance that thunderstorms will be along the Florida coast tomorrow until around 2:30 in the afternoon. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 5 points to close at 3,290.70. This is NPR News. The nation's freight trains are at a standstill after a strike against one rail company and a shutdown for the rest. Working against a midnight deadline, talks had stalled on salaries and work rules. Officials of the Bush administration have called on Congress to step in. But key members of Congress have indicated that they will let a shutdown go on for at least 36 to 48 hours before intervening. While most Amtrak service continues between Washington and Boston, operations have been suspended on most runs on tracks owned by the freight lines. Commuter rail service in the New York, Boston, and Chicago areas is, for the most part, not affected by the shutdown. In South Africa, President F.W. de Klerk has asked the African National Congress to take part in 2 days of emergency talks, following the ANC walkout from all formal talks. But the ANC has turned down the request. Tom Carver reports from Johannesburg.
The president said his government was in a hurry to get on with the move to a new South Africa. He strongly denied claims that the government was in any way involved in the political violence and refused to comment on the various demands of the ANC. Instead, he proposed a two-day session of talks. This has already been rejected by the ANC, who cannot afford at this stage to be seen to be getting into any sort of discussions with the government. Although it is clear that the ANC has not broken off all lines of communication, their Secretary General has already been in contact with government ministers. By way of an olive branch, President de Klerk suggested that international experts should come to assess the role of the police in the recent Boipatong massacre. However, that made little impact on the ANC, which is now determined to extract major concessions from the government. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Carver in Johannesburg.
In Washington, the government said today that orders for durable goods fell 2.4% last month, pushed down by a drop in transportation equipment orders. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of our pop music has its roots in the black church. There's plenty of examples of great singers who broke out of the low-paying, low-visibility world of gospel music to become pop stars. Here's rock historian Ed Ward with just a few of them.
One of these mornings I'm going away. Any day now I'm going to heaven.
The most famous example, of course, was Sam Cooke, who came to prominence with one of gospel's top groups, the Soul Stirrers. Pious gospel fans never fail to mention how Cooke, just a few years into his pop career, was gunned down by a woman in a cheap motel. But they always forget that Johnny Taylor, who replaced Cooke, is still going strong as a soul singer today. Sam Cooke was something of an exception to the gospel-to-pop rule, though. Usually those who make the change aren't very successful in gospel and hope that pop music will turn their luck around. A prime example is the Royal Sons.
I'll let nothing separate me from God's love. Oh yes, I'll let nothing separate.
After making a few dull gospel records like this in the early 50s, they were persuaded to change their name to the Five Royales and set about revolutionizing black pop music of their day. And speaking of revolutionaries, here's one. Aretha Franklin was raised in the church of her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, and was surrounded by the finest gospel talent of the times. Only 16 when she recorded this selection, Aretha's gone back to do a couple of gospel albums in later years, including one with her mentor, the late Reverend James Cleveland. Conservatives, too, come from the church.
Oh, watchy. Ooh. Why don't you watchy there for? For you know not the day, said when my Lord, when my blessed Savior shall call your soul away. And yes, if you're laboring.
You probably weren't thinking of Lou Rawls, but that was him in 1954, singing with the Chosen Gospel Singers, an old-timey a cappella group. Rawls came to pop slowly. He modernized his gospel sound first with the Pilgrim Travelers, and then toured with Sam Cooke, singing pop for a while, before striking out on his solo career. Not many examples of famous soul singers doing gospel exist, although I swear that on an obscure recording by the Wings Over Jordan Choir, you can hear 8-year-old Gladys Knight, And there are recordings of 60s soul phenomenons Laura Lee and Fontella Bass with their family's gospel groups. Just imagine James Brown with the group he formed in prison. But this works the other way, too. And I'll leave you with the story of another great talent who's never left the church, Shirley Caesar.
I'd like to tell you something about my life. Glory to God. You know I like to talk to the young people sometimes. I want every singer, every choir member to hear my testimony. We were down in Birmingham, Alabama one night. I never will forget it. As we walked off the stage, a white man met me there. He said, Shirley, I've been sent from New York City. He had a contract in his hand. Yes, he did. I said, I can't sing the rock and roll. I had to tell him these words. I love the Lord, he heard me cry.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air.
Tell Agent Cooper that Albert and his team are here.
Albert?
A-L-B-E-R-T. Are we gonna have to stand here all afternoon?
No.
Albert Rosenfield. R-O-S-E-N-F-I-E-L-D.
Twin Peaks fans remember my guest Miguel Ferrer as Albert, the arrogant FBI pathologist. Now Ferrer is starring in the new TV series from Twin Peaks creators David Lynch and Mark Frost. It's called On the Air, and it's a comedy about what happens behind the scenes of a 1957 live TV variety show. Ferrer plays the head of the Zablotnik Broadcasting Company.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's our belief that tonight, America will be watching Lester Guy, starring in the Lester Guy Show. All of our research indicates that America wants to see movie stars on television. And we are all so grateful that a star the caliber of Lester Guy has agreed to star in the Lester Guy Show on Zablotnik Broadcasting Corporation National Television.
On the Air isn't Ferrer's first role as an executive. He was a bad guy exec in the film RoboCop. Ferrer is the son of singer Rosemary Clooney and the late actor Jose Ferrer. Before he started acting, he was a drummer in rock groups and big bands. He's also co-created several comics for Marvel. I told him I thought his role in On the Air was continuing his image as one of the suits.
It's interesting because before RoboCop, no one would ever let me wear a suit. I would complain to my agent, why don't I ever get to try it for a doctor or a lawyer? They said, nobody would buy you as that, Miguel. You know, come on, put on the leather jacket and go be the nun rapist. And so that's what I did on every episodic TV show and some very bad movies for several years. And then since RoboCop, I've hardly been out of a suit. But they all do wear suits, but I think that they're very different kinds of guys.
Well, they're all crazy, though. That's one thing that holds them together.
Yeah, that's true.
They're insane members of the suit establishment. Now, how did David Lynch describe On the Air to you when he recruited you for it, assuming he was the one who described it to you?
He really didn't describe it. He just he called me. I was doing just finishing a rather short order of a very bad television series up in Vancouver, and he called me up and said, "We've got this script. It's called On the Air, and I think it could be a very good thing." That's what he said, and he sent me the script, and that's how I described it.
So he didn't describe what the story would be or your character.
Not really. He told me the name of my character, which he said, "You're going to be Bud Budwaller." Oh, okay, that clears it up for me, Dave. No, but so he just sent the script. He really didn't attempt to describe the show at all before I got the material.
How did you get your role on Twin Peaks as the FBI pathologist Albert Rosenfield, who Agent Cooper describes as lacking in some of the social niceties,
to say the least? How did I get that? David Lynch saw RoboCop when it first came out, and he contacted my representatives back then, I guess it was in 87, and wanted to meet with me in regarding a project that he had in development at the now defunct De Laurentiis Entertainment Group. That company went away, as did the project, so that movie never got made. And then years later, I got a call from David's people saying, would you be interested in a possible recurring role in this new series, Twin Peaks? And without seeing a script or without seeing the pilot, I just said, yes, absolutely. I'm such a fan of his work. I said, yeah, I'll carry a spear. I'll do whatever you want. And it was just a great surprise when I finally saw the pilot and saw how terrific it was. You know, so that's how that came about.
Since Lynch discovered you through RoboCop, let me find out how you got that role. And you were one of the kind of corrupt, egocentric executives. Well, young executives.
Yeah.
Who takes on the RoboCop program.
Anyway, the way I got that one was the casting director was a friend, and I had worked for her before. She'd cast me in a couple of things, and she originally wanted me to come in for one of the gang guys, and I read the script and I said, well, that's fine, I'd love to do that part, but I really would like to do this other part. Bob Morton, the executive, she goes, God, I never would have thought of you for that, but you know, sure, if you want to take a whack at it, come on in. And it worked out. So,
and I guess it really did change the direction of your career.
Sure did. Yeah, it was a good thing.
I'm interested in your background. Now, you're the son of Rosemary Clooney, the singer, and the actor Jose Ferrer. How aware were you of their talents when you were growing up?
Gosh, that's a hard question. You know, probably not very, because that's what you grow up seeing. You sort of take it for granted. I don't think it was until I was maybe in high school that I really started appreciating the magnitude of my parents' gifts and contributions to what they did. You know, they were just mom and dad, and they had a great sense of who they were. They never felt that they were curing cancer or doing any very important work on any kind of a global scale. They had great jobs, and they were lucky enough to be good at them. And they enjoyed what they did, and that's sort of where it, you know, they. Some of these people in show business really have an inflated sense of what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think, and that was not the case with my folks.
Your parents were separated during part of your growing up, and they got back together again, separated again. Was that confusing for you?
I never knew that they were separated the first time. Tell you the truth, I only found that out in my late teens. It was kind of a surprise. What? You're kidding.
How could you not know?
I was just told my dad was off making a movie for about a year and a half.
Oh.
Yeah. Strange.
So why do you think they wanted to keep it from you?
I don't know. I don't know what their thinking was on that either. And then he came back for a little while, and then when he finally left the second time, my mom sort of brought us all in and one by one told us the news. And you know, it's a strange feeling for kids to hear that. So,
it's public too that your mother, for a period of years, had problems with pills, you know, with pharmaceuticals. Did you know what was happening when she was in that period?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's hard to conceal a problem that serious, which hers certainly was.
What was your age period during that time?
Gosh, I guess anywhere from, this is a rough guess, I guess 9 or 10 to 13 when she finally got some help.
Right. Was it hard for you to talk to her then?
At times, you know, at times it wasn't. At times she was just mom, but there were other times where, I mean, she had a lot of problems. She really, really did. She was working way too hard, by herself most of the time, traveling way too much, and just carrying an enormous burden, a bigger one than anyone should have to. And, You know, she just attempted to anesthetize herself. So at those times, it was hard to talk to her. It's hard to talk to anyone who's completely wasted, you know. But there were, not to make it sound that there weren't wonderful times with her during those years, because there were.
Mm-hmm. Seeing your mother go through that, did that lead you away from drugs and things like that yourself? I mean, or... And I think it's very hard to grow up with somebody who's been an abuser of any sort, and, you know, kids have different reactions to it when they come of age.
Yeah, for some reason, it didn't stop me from jumping into the thick of it, to tell you the truth. You know, I started high school in 1969, just caught the tail end of the hippie thing, and I took a lot of acid and smoked a lot of pot and all that stuff, and... Luckily, I'm none the worse for wear. But no, my mother's abuse didn't really factor into my thinking, my adolescent thinking. I was just, got him out of Catholic school, in public school. You know, they're girls. Oh, my God. You know, this is great. I just kind of immersed myself in rock and roll and marijuana and girls.
So tell me, when you have a new series on the air, like On the Air, do you watch it when it's actually on TV?
Yeah, I watched the first one the other night. I'd seen it a few times, and I'll be watching the others because I've not seen them outside of when we went in to, you know, fix some of the sound. It's called looping. I'm sure, I don't know if you know what that is, but
that's when you
I've just seen
overdub
those little bits
something.
And pieces of the other episodes. So yeah, I'll be watching them with anticipation. It seemed really, really funny when we were doing it, so I expect good things.
Can you give us a preview of what's coming up this Saturday on
Air? I don't know what order they're airing these things in. I'm told that they're not airing them in the order in which we shot them, so I don't know what show is coming up this weekend.
Do you feel a little bit out of control here?
In what way?
Well, I mean that, you know, you haven't seen the shows and you don't know what order they're in.
Yeah, I certainly don't feel out of control in that way. I feel in perfectly good hands with the folks over at Lynch Frost. To be honest with you, I feel very much out of control with, and I'm really happy to be here, actually, talking to the folks and saying, please watch the show. You know, I think most of us involved in the show are very disappointed with our you know, night the show is airing and our time slot and the fact that we're in the summer and the... apparent lack of support that we're receiving from our network. It's kind of disheartening when you work as hard as we did, the long hours, and just give 110%. And, you know, maybe it's a misperception on my part, but it sure seems like we're not getting any support.
Actor Miguel Ferrer stars in On the Air, Saturday nights on ABC. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the Israeli elections?
Well, we have a report on some reaction from Hebron, a city in the West Bank, from Jewish settlers and also from Palestinians there. A report by Linda Gradstein, who's in Israel. Also, I'll be talking with Avraham Burg, who is a member of the Labour Party, was number 3 on their national list after former Prime Minister Rabin and also Shimon Peres. Avraham Burg talks about what the next government's policies will actually be with respect to the peace process and negotiations with Palestinians. Also in today's program, news of the Supreme Court rulings on school prayer and cigarettes.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Three nights this week, NBC is presenting different episodes of its new comedy series, Home Fires. TV critic David Bianculli says this disappointing series comes from one of the best production teams in television.
To paraphrase Will Rogers, I never saw a Bruce Paltrow TV show I didn't like. Until now. Paltrow may not be as well known as, say, Stephen Bochco, but he's got just as impressive a track record. Paltrow created The White Shadow and was the main force behind Saint Elsewhere, my favorite drama series of the 80s. More recently, Paltrow and his team of writer-producers concocted Tattingers, a one-hour drama about a New Yorker who ran an upscale restaurant. He also did Nick and Hillary, a half-hour sitcom that had somehow spun out of Tattingers. Both of those last shows were ratings bombs, but I liked them anyway. So from my point of view, Paltrow could do no wrong. Then came Home Fires. In a way, Home Fires is a lot like Nick and Hillary. Both shows are about a married couple, hometown boy, uptown girl, with a lush lifestyle and some precocious teenagers. In Home Fires, Michael Brandon and Kate Burton play the Kramers, and Nicole Eggert and Jared Paul play their teen children. She's entering college, he's entering puberty. And as a prologue to each episode, these parents and children show up individually for family counseling. The therapist is played by Norman Lloyd, who played kindly old Dr. Auschlander on St. Elsewhere. But even he's overshadowed and undercut by the worst thing about Home Fires, the laugh track. Home Fires is shot on film, with lots of intercutting within scenes, so a laugh track doesn't make any sense. And this one sounds so mechanical and unnatural, it's... well, listen for yourself.
Think of your marriage in terms of a jigsaw puzzle. How would you describe it, simple or difficult?
Difficult.
Simple.
Simple.
Difficult.
Not that I'm whining.
Not that I'm complaining.
Oh, we have arguments, but not like we used to.
Even when you're mad enough to strangle each other, you know, it's not going to be your last fight.
You learn to choose your battles carefully. You want to be Schwarzkopf, not Custer.
Isn't that awful? And unfortunately, a lot of the dialogue isn't much better. And it's hard to get too worked up when the problems are on the level of whether to schedule a European vacation or if the private French tutor is too sexy.
Leave your brother alone.
Did you see who he's gotten there?
Shauna seems like a very nice girl.
Nice is not the word. Shauna Cheeseman Dodge generates enough heat to blister paint.
She is pretty.
I just hope Jesse's hormonal receptors can handle the overload.
She's just tutoring him in French.
On a Saturday morning? They're in there conjugating, but not irregular verbs.
Paltrow and his partners Tom Fontana and John Tinker have cast the show well. I mean, the actors aren't the problem here. And Nicole Eggert as the daughter almost makes up for all those years spent on Charles in Charge. But there's not much fun in this sitcom, and surprisingly, not much heart. If you want to watch the Kramer family try to work out its difficulties, skip Home Fires and go out and rent Kramer vs. Kramer.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of the new book, Teleliteracy. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Thad Kirk and Richard Parker are our engineers. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association is holding its first conference in San Francisco. On the next Fresh Air, we'll meet the group's founder, Roy Ahrens. He's the former executive editor of the Oakland Tribune and former New York and West Coast correspondent for the Washington Post. He says he spent much of his career leading a double life. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.